Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Okay, like the man just told you, I'm Jim. And hopefully you're in the right place for Indie Author Answers, because that's what we're doing here. If you came here for something else, get the heck out. Okay, anyway. So now let's go ahead and get started with the show, all right? How you guys doing? I'm doing well. This is end of August, right, or beginning of September when this comes out, so I've just put out a couple books in August. That was exciting. The fourth book in my Five Sun Saga series, Against the Infinity, and also the Five Sun Saga Omnibus Edition, which went wide to Amazon, Kobo, and iTunes. And I've been considering putting it out on some place like Scribd and other stuff like that, but I'm just going to hold off on that for now and see how we're doing with that. Anyway, that's all there is to say about me, because you guys don't really, you know, whatever. You're not here to hear about my books. You're here to talk about the one book that we read on the show, and we're going to get to that soon. Be a little more patient. Let's do a tip of the week. What do we want to talk about this week? I think this week we should talk about a particular writing myth that I hear all the time and it bugs the crap out of me. And that myth is the saggy middle. Yeah, that's right, the saggy middle. I know it sounds like a prog rock band's album title, but no, actually what we're talking about is this thing that a lot of people believe and actually a lot of fiction suffers from, is when the middle of a book gets boring. I know you as readers have encountered books where the beginning is exciting and the end is exciting and then the middle is just boring. And Stephen King is a great example of someone who is, his books are terribly afflicted by this. I can think of lots of books that I read when I was younger, like Needful Things and Tommyknockers, that had these exciting intros and then they were just boring for like 400 pages. You know, after the first couple hundred pages of exciting stuff, then they were boring and then they would ramp up at the end. And this bothers me because it's sort of a commonly accepted thing that the middles of books tend to drag. And I don't think they have to. I have a really simple solution for how you can get the middle of your book not to drag. Here you go. You ready for it? Have something exciting happen. Boom. We're done. You guys can just cut me a check that I'll go cash. That's pretty much it. You know, I don't get it. I don't get why you can't have something exciting happen in the middle of your book. Like a great example is Gillian Flynn. Her books are all, they're kind of formulaic. I mean, I know she's only written like three or four of them, but they're essentially formulaic in that she does the pretty typical plot twist thing of having plot twist at 25%, then one at 50%, then one at 99%, basically. But if you look at Gone Girl, and I won't spoil anything if you are one of the few hundred people in the world who haven't either read the book or seen the movie, but at the 50% point of that book, there's a plot twist that turns the whole book on its head. That's the kind of thing that you need to do to avoid the saggy middle. Have something exciting happen, or have a plot twist that changes things, and that's going to drive people on. Like in my novel, Reagan's Ashes, I won't spoil anything, but basically the biggest action scene, the most exciting, or probably not, but one of the most exciting thing that happens in that book happens right at the midpoint, and it changes things for the rest of the book, and then the book kind of goes off in a little bit of a different direction. It's still sort of heading towards the same point that you might anticipate from the beginning, but something happens and it changes things, and it sparks new life into the book at that point where it could have just been saggy and boring and plodding on toward the end, blah, bitty, blah. So, in summation, saggy middle, just say no. Do something exciting. have a plot twist, change something, take the book in a new direction. Just don't be boring. Just say no. Okay. All right, guys, that's all we're going to rant and rave about writing myths. I think I might make that a series where I talk about myths that people believe, that writers believe and readers may or may not expect. But anyway, let's move on past that and get on to our reading. This week, we are going to read Part 3, Chapter 12 in The Problematic Virtue. It's a short one, about 1,100 words, and I'm not going to promise you that this will be a short episode because every time I do that, I tend to ramble on anyway. So this episode's going to be about as long as it takes, and that's as much as I'm going to promise you. Anyway, so if you remember last week, we read a section that had two chapters, a Brian chapter and a Wiles chapter. And in the Brian chapter, he was downtown in Boulder on Pearl Street, and he went to get a coffee, and he had a failed attempt at flirting with this girl, and then his buddy Graham, the one who used to be Alex's roommate, met up with him and was like, hey, let's go smoke some weed. And Brian was like, no, I don't know, I should go study. And so Graham was like, well, let's go get something to eat anyway. And if you remember that, I made a big deal at the beginning of the chapter about how I flashed forward into Brian's thinking. I broke POV there a little bit to talk about how soon Brian would be holding the body of a dying man in his arms. And now, this week, this chapter, your long wait is over. We are going to find out what happened with that. Okay? Ready? Here we go. Part 3, Chapter 12, Brian. Brian and Graham detoured to a side street and walked towards the Walnut Brewery. Lightning struck off to the west, and the urgent, reverberating boom of thunder rolled up and down the Flatiron Mountains. How is your older woman girlfriend? Brian said. Oh, we split up, mate. But we're still working through our breakup sex bit, so I'm enjoying that. It's all going to plan. What's the plan? Well, the general rule is that you have post-breakup sex once for every 3 months you were together. We dated for a year, and we've had sex twice since we split, so I've got two more freebies coming, Graham said. I see. What's going on with your roommate? He looked in rough shape last time I was over at your apartment. He looks like that a lot these days, Brian said. Having him as her roommate has been an adventure, you could say. We fight a lot, like a married couple or I don't know what. So, living with Alex hasn't turned out to be like the utopia you read about in the advert? I don't like constantly having to ask him to do his own dishes. I'm not his mother. And he has people over to our place all the time, people I don't know, the kind of people with a bunch of piercings and weird body art. Some guy came over the other day, and he had a shaved head and a spider web tattooed in place of hair like he's a comic book character. I'll come home and he's got all these weird kids over and they look at me like I'm an intruder. Plus he runs with Wiles constantly now, although Wiles doesn't ever show at our apartment. Alex slings stuff right out of our living room. Alex is selling what, pot? No, I think he's selling real drugs, like coke or meth or worse. Some of the people who come by our house are extremely sketchy. You should tell him that it bothers you. Brian opened his hands wide as they crossed a street in a kind of surrender. Well, here's the thing. It does bother me, but I don't want to be a dick about it. I mean, it's his house too. He pays rent. So do I have a right to tell him who he can and can't have over? I sell weed too, so who am I to judge him, right? Weed and meth are two very different things, mate. For the first time, Brian had a chance to share his frustrations with someone willing to listen. True, and he just wants to party all the time. I don't think he even goes to class, and having to live with him is really disruptive. I'm just not at all about getting high and chasing tail anymore. Oh, come on, Graham said. Don't play like you still don't get high. Okay, fair enough, but not like I used to. And not like he does now. I came back to school so I could get a degree, not skip class and chase girls. All those distractions at the apartment, if I flunk even one class, I'm in serious trouble. You can see why I come to the library to study. One more street crossing and they would be at the restaurant. Do you want him to move out? No, I don't. If he moves out, who knows what happens to him? I think that would be worse. Well, this is quite a tale, my friend, Graham said. But no worries, because at least for the time being, you can drown your sorrow in a Walnut Brewery Asiago cheese bread appetizer. I don't see how that can't improve things. The escalating whir sound of wheels turning suggested a rapidly approaching bicycle. Brian realized the sound came from right behind them on the same sidewalk. The cyclist shouted something about making room, and Brian pushed Graham out of the way. The cyclist, traveling much too fast for an overcrowded sidewalk, rushed past them. Graham raised a fist and yelled, "That's what the bloody bike lanes are for, arsehole!" The cyclist looked back at Graham, and time slowed as Brian locked on him. Something about the cyclist's eyes struck Brian as odd. The cyclist opened his mouth to reply to Graham, but by then, his bike had slipped off the sidewalk and drifted out into an intersection. In a flash, a car slammed into him. The sounds of the car honking and metal puckering turned into a singular auditory screech. The bike went skidding one way while the cyclist scraped along the road in the other direction, his body flopping like a fish on dry land as he involuntarily crossed the street. He was not wearing a helmet, and he easily might be dead, even though he had only slid 20 feet or so. Brian, Graham, and several more onlookers rushed over to the twisted figure sprawled in the street with his face down on the pavement. A small pool of blood began to develop underneath the cyclist's head. Brian crouched down and carefully turned the guy over by the shoulders so that his head was no longer in the pool of... And that's when Brian realized that the cyclist had two different colored eyes. When he was a child, Brian's family had a dog with heterochromia, but he had never seen that feature in a human. That odd spectacle would burn into his brain for days afterwards. People nearby did all the things that people do during this type of incident. Scream, cry, shout for an ambulance, scramble for cell phones, direct traffic away from the accident. The commotion was a muffled roar, like listening through the wall to the neighbor's loud television. Brian, with his hands still gripping the young man's shoulders, tried to snap his own paralysis, but he became lost in those mismatched eyes. "You identify with this situation, but you are not this bicycle accident. There is no meaning in this accident." The man was alive and looking right at Brian. He whispered something at Brian, but Brian could not make out the words. The lips moved and the sound blurred like waves of musical notes. He leaned closer. "What did you say?" The cyclist whispered again and closed his eyes. The words still came out as an indiscernible mess, muffled under the chaos around them. Brian asked Graham if he had heard what the cyclist said. Graham, mouth agape, only shook his head. Brian lowered the cyclist to the ground and then looked at his own trembling, stained red hands. He realized he might never know. And so there you have it, the payoff for last week about we were finally get to find out what this bloody person Brian is holding. It's a little bit of a letdown because it's not like he was involved in the violence anyhow, which would have made it personal and would have made it more a better story. He just saw somebody get in a bicycle crash. If you remember way back in chapter one or maybe three, it was the chapter early on in part one where Brian walks back from Heather's apartment. It's the chapter where he meets Alex for the first time. I believe, at least in an earlier version, I had included a scene as he was walking back and he was stoned where he almost gets run over by a cyclist. And it was this cyclist. And I even included that the cyclist had two different colored eyes, because you remember I've talked a few weeks ago about how I felt this insistent need that if a character appeared once, they had to appear again. But I believe I might have cut the cyclist out, so I can't even remember if it's in if I've talked about it on the podcast before. But the podcast, cyclist, does make an appearance in a later chapter in a dream sequence or something like that. So I did find a way to use him again. Anyway, so let's go back and talk about this chapter. So Brian and Graham, they're walking towards the brewery. And then if you remember the last time that Brian and Graham had a chat, there was the thing about half your age plus seven, where Graham spit the knowledge about how, you know, the youngest you can date is someone who's half your age plus 7 years. And so Graham gives us another little bit of dating culture lore here by talking about the breakup sex. I think I heard someone tell me this once, that you're supposed to have post-breakup sex once for every 3 months that you dated. And I just thought that was amusing, so I stuck it in here. And this is the kind of thing, you know, it's fine to insert bits of real-life conversation into fiction. It gives it some nice flavor. Just make sure that it actually has something to do with the story. Or else, I mean, everybody wants to be Quentin Tarantino and have characters talk about nothing just to be entertaining. But not everyone can be Quentin Tarantino and actually make it work. And sometimes Tarantino doesn't make it work. Some of his dialogue in his movies is just boring. Anyway, so they quickly transition from talking about how many times you get to have sex with someone you broke up with to talking about Alex. And that is the brunt of this chapter, is Brian complaining about living with Alex. And Graham is just functioning as a sounding board here, while Brian basically gives a lot of exposition about how much Alex has changed since they knew each other the first time when they were both at college before. He describes living with Alex as an adventure and that they fight like a married couple. Now, we are going to see later Brian and Alex having one of these kinds of domestic squabbles. I'm not sure how much further on, but pretty soon they're going to be fighting about the dishes or something like that, and it's going to turn nasty. But as I'm reading through this, and where he's talking about Alex has these sketchy people over and I don't like them, and he's selling drugs out of the house, I'm reading that and I'm thinking, God, this would be nice to see this instead of Brian just recounting it to Graham. Because this is the kind of thing, like, he's describing great conflict here. Brian's at the house or the apartment. He wants to study. Alex wants to have these weird people over so he can sell them drugs and party in the apartment. There's the description of some really nice tension there, but we don't get to see any of that, do we? It's just described in hindsight. So there's a good storytelling lesson there. In showing versus telling, if you have a great chance to display some conflict, by all means show it instead of telling us it. And so the point of this conversation is also to describe, you know, it accomplishes a couple things. One, it shows us that Alex, as Brian has been suspecting since the last couple chapters, Alex is getting more and more into drugs. And it also demonstrates that Alex and Brian are drifting further and further apart. Now, if you remember before, as soon as we started on part three, I said, really, the book could start here. Because this is really where the conflict and tension, part three and part four of the book, is where they really ramp up. At the time, I think I felt like I needed to show all the stuff in part one where Alex and Brian are friends. But really, I could have started the book where they meet to move in together, and maybe they're getting along in the first couple chapters, or maybe there's tension right away. And then there could have just been flashbacks or references, exposition-y kinds of references to the time before when they were getting along together. Like, we didn't need to see all that stuff about them getting along and mentoring, you know, Brian mentoring Alex and Alex being impressionable and naive. We didn't really need to see any of that stuff. It didn't really accomplish anything. I guess that's not entirely true. I mean, it did accomplish something. Like, it makes the fact that Brian and Alex are drifting further apart a little more painful. But I don't know if I really needed to spend 100 pages of the book setting up their relationship. That probably could have mostly been axed, and the story would have been fine. So they're talking about what kinds of drugs Alex is selling. And this is an amusing line, I think, where Graham says, Alex is selling what, pot? And Brian says, no, I think he's selling real drugs. Which, if you know anyone who smokes pot, a lot of people don't consider it a real drug. I didn't when I was a teenager and I smoked pot. Anyway, don't do drugs, kids. Okay, moving on. So Graham is saying, you know, you should tell him that the selling drugs bother you. And Brian kind of is meek about it. He's not very... You know, I've talked many times about what a poor protagonist Brian is, because he doesn't stand up for himself. He's not confident. He doesn't speak his mind. And that's one of his character arcs, one of his half-hearted, half-assed character arcs, is that he goes from being sort of meek and not speaking up for himself to being someone who's confident. And I'll tell you, if you're writing a character who goes from being meek to being confident, that is a really hard sell, because readers don't really like meek characters. There are some exceptions. The character has to be exceptional in other areas. Like, Harry Potter is a good example. Harry Potter is really meek. But if you think about it, like, in the first book, when he gets to Hogwarts, as soon as he picks up a broom, he's a natural. He's a natural at flying. And so He may be meek and he doesn't know how to speak up for himself, but he's good at stuff. And he's also so wronged, you feel a lot of sympathy for him. So he's sympathetic and he is good at stuff. So the fact that he's not very proactive and not very confident doesn't matter as much. But in this case, Brian is meek. He's not proactive. He doesn't do stuff. He's mostly reactive. He's not really good at stuff. I mean, there's this whole thing about him being good with his hands and good at selling drugs. But being good at sleight of hand doesn't really improve his character all that much, as in my opinion. Anyway, so they're just talking about Alex selling drugs, and here's an interesting bit of overwriting. So they're talking back and forth about what Alex is doing, and then there's Lyons says, for the first time, Brian had a chance to share his frustrations with someone willing to listen, which is essentially explaining everything that's happened. We know Brian is excited about talking to Graham. We could assume Brian hasn't talked to anyone else about this because we haven't seen it, so that line there doesn't really serve any purpose. And, you know, Brian then goes on to complain more about how Alex doesn't go to class. He doesn't really, he's not into getting high and chasing tail. And then Graham says, you know, you still get high. And Brian says, yeah, I do still get high. And so that's kind of confusing there because we're seeing them drift, but Brian still gets high. It probably would have been better, more consistent characterization if Brian was off weed altogether. Then we could see a definite split between them. You know, Brian doesn't want to be around weed smoke. Alex is smoking weed all the time. So it is kind of confusing that Brian still smokes pot sometimes. Like, we don't know how much he smokes. We don't know why he's only smoking a little bit. It's all kind of confusing there. Then we get into the quote-unquote exciting thing that happens in the chapter. This cyclist comes rushing along. And then Brian... he rushes right past Graham and Brian. Graham yells at him, and the cyclist turns around, and this is what causes him to drift out in traffic and get hit by the car. But then we get the note here about his two different colored eyes. Now, I think I originally included that because if you remember back what I said, 10 minutes ago, I was talking about how he was in Chapter 3, and I had probably noted his different colored eyes then. And so Brian would see the two different colored eyes and go, OMG, that's the same cyclist. But I think I took that out, and so the reason why it's here now is, I'm not really sure, maybe I just wanted to use the word heterochromia for some reason, because we get this flashback to how Brian had a dog with two different colored eyes, which is heterochromia. We get this description of him going out in the street, the cars honking, the metals puckering, an auditory screech. I think this description works pretty well. It's quick, but it gives you enough detail about what's happening, and the POV isn't too terribly distant. And we also do get a bit of Brian being a little bit proactive here, because as the cyclist rushes by, Brian pushes Graham out of the way. For most of the book, Brian is a pretty reactive protagonist, and that's what makes him a shitty protagonist. He doesn't do a whole lot. But in this instance, he does do something. He helps Graham, and I probably should have paid a little bit more attention to that. Brian pushes Graham out of the way. Graham falls down. Brian helps him up. Graham says, thank you for that, mate, whatever, to call attention to it. Because Brian's so reactive, him being proactive is a mark in his favor, and that should be called out. Anyway, so we're describing the scene. The onlookers are doing what they usually do, screaming, crying for an ambulance, looking at their phones. So we get a pretty good description of the crowd that's going on. Brian rushes to him, and then we have this interesting this two-sentence paragraph here that's supposed to be it's kind of a half-assed reference to Brian's Buddhism, which says, you identify with the situation, but you are not this bicycle accident. There is no meaning in this accident. And if you were like, if you didn't know that Brian was a Buddhist, and you would look at that and go, what the hell is that for? It's like this totally, completely random thought right in the middle of this exciting scene. It just rips you right out of the story. So that should definitely be axed. That whole thing about meaning in the accident, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't affect the story in any way. It doesn't really make Brian more sympathetic. It doesn't make him more interesting. So that should definitely go. So then the cyclist tries to talk to Brian, and Brian can't hear it. And so that's the cliffhanger of the chapter, is that he doesn't know what the cyclist says. And I think whatever the cyclist says might come into play later for some reason, maybe in the dream sequence, but I can't remember. So the chapter ends right after this horrific thing. I think at the time when I wrote this, the cyclist getting hit by the car was supposed to symbolize something. Maybe it was supposed to symbolize the oncoming collision of Alex and Brian, or the collision of Brian and Wiles, or Brian and someone else. It's probably supposed to symbolize something, but you know, the fact that I wrote this book and I can't even tell you what it symbolizes now says a lot. I may have just thrown it in there hoping that somebody might think that it symbolized something and might have thought that it was deep. I don't even know. Who knows? Whatever. So I think that's all I have to say about this chapter. Next week, we're going to be reading the chapter where Alex and Wiles go into that shady trailer park and go do some stuff there, and things are going to start to get a little more and more exciting from here on out as we get deeper into the story. Thanks everyone for listening. Now you're going to have to stick around for the outro. You're not allowed to turn the podcast off until it's over. And why? Because I say so. All right, see you guys.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad, we will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So come on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.